Welcome to Curious Canadian History. I'm your host, David Boris. Back in episode 4, myself and historian Per Anders Rudlin spoke in length about the history behind Ukrainian Waffen SS veterans settling in Canada in the aftermath of the Second World War. This discussion was triggered by the embarrassing moment in Canada's Parliament where parliamentarians gave a former Waffen SS soldier a standing ovation. Our conversation was so good and there was so much covered that we decided to turn it into a two-parter. Thus, in part two of our discussion, we explore why the history of Waffen SS veterans in Canada took so long to come out, what this says about Canada, what it means for Canadian history and the history of Ukrainians in Canada, and finally, the serious backlash that Per has received while uncovering this issue, including serious efforts to silence Per. This is Season 9, Episode 6, The SS in Canada, Part 2. We continue this great conversation with me asking Per how the discovery of Waffen SS veterans in Canada affects the broader geopolitical situation in Ukraine.
Harming Ukraine. But in the U.S., the discussions here now about cutting the funding, Slovakia voted for pro-Putin government right now. And what's worse, these are main use, you know, in Malaysia, main use in India, in South Africa, in Brazil, in those countries which are not supporting of Ukraine and looking for reasons not to do so. I got 4 phone calls today from India. I want to hear all about the Ukrainian Nazis. It plays into a certain narrative that is harming Ukraine. But I don't want to make this an issue about Ukraine, which I do support, but this is a Canadian fiasco, a Canadian fiasco. Yes. Or even more so, Universal Alberta fiasco, Ukrainian-Canadian fiasco. And I don't feel good about it. You know, I part of me say, well, you know, this is exactly what I was warning about. And they went into this willfully. On the other hand, I don't want this to happen. I mean, why can't a liberal, democratic, well-functioning, tolerant, progressive society like Canada address this? You know, that question is not so much a polemical one. As something I'm genuinely interested in, you know? Why do I have Waffen SS memorials in Canada? And why did we arrive at this situation? There's sort of philosophical, political issues of how to manage a postmodern, liberal, democratic, multi-ethnic society. And I think they're profound questions that should be asked.
And you're absolutely right. And just for our listeners, you know, Per is not understating the fact when we were doing our grad school together, we talked about this. This was 2005, 2006. We were there together at U of A, and Per was bringing this up, and this is a real thing. And I really love the way you framed it. This is a Canadian, this is University of Alberta. This is a Canadian and a Ukrainian issue. This is not a knock against Ukraine. This is not weird propaganda coup. Well, it is a propaganda coup for Putin, isn't it? I mean, at the end of the day, he can still use this for his advantage, but it would be bastardized to say this is something about Ukraine. This is really about Alberta. This is about Canada. This is about the University of Alberta and the Ukrainian-Canadian community. I mean, and this speaks to another question that we want to talk about a little bit is, let's talk about the diaspora memory a little bit in Alberta, because you and me have talked extensively about this. And again, for my listeners, I am of descent of the Galician Ukrainian Canadians. Like, this is, you know, I in 2018, I went back to southeastern Poland, you know, which to my village, which was part of Galicia. So this is something that hits home for me as well and my family as well. And let's talk about the diaspora for a second. How is the diaspora influential in shaping the narratives in the post-war period?
Well, the diaspora wasn't originally monolithic. You had several waves, right? You know, I believe your family belonged to the so-called first wave. They came before World War One, right? From the Habsburg Empire, right? They were usually apolitical. They were religious. They wanted land and whatnot, right? Then you had a second wave that came in the interwar period. Many of them were actually quite radical. The Canadian Communist Party had papers in Ukrainian, in Yiddish, and Finnish. They belonged to the radical community, but also then had a very right-wing section of identifying with radical Ukrainian nationalism of the OUN, the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. Then came this massive wave after 1945 or 1948. And among them, according to the CIA and the International Tracing Service on estimates, about 80% of them were sympathetic to the OUN, right? And these were much more educated. They were urban, they were more sophisticated, and they came to take over little by little many of the community functions in the 1950s and 60s. And the organization of Ukrainian nationalists, which the Bandera wing of them, which was the strongest one, the emigre political party, joined the Ukrainian Canadian Congress or committee then in 1959, and increasingly came to take over the functions. By the 1980s, 1990s, the memory politics of the Ukrainian Canadian Congress was almost one to one, very similar to that of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. The memory politics there is not to be confused with Ukrainians as such. You know, it's primarily a third wave, you know, the post-war emigres, which were not Ukrainian, well, we were Ukrainian, but were not Ukrainian as such. They came from this territory of Halychyna, and to some extent also from Volhynia and Bukovina. They were Western Ukrainians, because the Allies sent back Soviet Ukrainians merciless to Stalin, to very, right, very painful destinies. So the selection there were all of the Western Ukrainians, and most of them were nationalistic. And they started building this narration. And of course, during the Cold War, I mean, they sold themselves as the West's most faithful allies. Right. And those questions about World War II and what they had done, you know, the pogroms, how the OUN systematically infiltrated the German auxiliary police, so-called Schutzmannschaften, then defected from the backbone of the Ukrainian insurgent army, which also took part in mass murder of Jews and killing up to 100,000 Poles. That sort of history was not discussed. Instead, of course, very strongly emphasizing a victimization narrative, the Holodomor, in which Ukrainians figure as victims.
Right.
And these were, of course, not people that had directly experienced the famine. These were Polish citizens. They came from Poland. But of course, not to sell the famine short. That was, you know, Stalin's single greatest crime against his own people. According to the most detailed demographic studies we have, Jacques Vallée's study from 2002, there was an excess mortality in the Ukrainian SSR, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, of 2.6 million people. Yeah, and the Ukrainian study estimated as high as 3.9 million people.
Right.
So a reasonable guesstimate would be perhaps 3.3 million people killed, or a little bit lower, a little bit higher. That makes it, you know, an enormous crime of proportions, almost unimaginable. And it was Stalin's greatest crime, and something that definitely should be studied and should be documented and should be commemorated. But when this is inflated to 7 million and being named the Holodomor, or to 10 million, and the most active people building these memorials, like, for instance, now in Edmonton, the first Holodomor memorial in the world, it was not yet called the Holodomor, but Ukrainian Famine Memorial. It was inaugurated by Petro Savarin, member of the Waffen-SS, somebody who came from Poland, somebody who had no experience of the famine as such directly. So you have here a Waffen-SS volunteer, blood group tattoo on his left and arm, now educating the Canadian public about genocide.
Yes.
And naming and inflating numbers 200-300%.
Yeah.
So that is also not doing anyone any justice. I think it was Timothy Snyder who wrote that by releasing millions of the souls and phantoms and ghosts of millions of people which never existed into sort of like a mental universe here, we are doing science or justice no justice. We need to be very careful about this. I mean, like, the Holocaust would not be either worse or less worse if I claimed there were 18 million people killed in the Holocaust. I mean, like, you know, one should be careful. There's a duty as an historian.
Yes.
But yes, they have this memory culture, you know, and when the Holocaust has come up with World War II has appeared, then, you know, the jerk reaction is, well, Holodomor, Ukrainian genocide, was much larger, you know. And in that sense, we're in a very unfortunate tug of war here, where I think both Stalin's horrific crimes should be and needs to be documented, and we need more of research into the Ukrainian famine, for sure.
It's fascinating because, first of all, we have this horrific, like, trend of Holocaust deniers, right? And they love to seize on anything that can possibly either prove the Holocaust didn't happen in their minds or diminish the Holocaust in their minds. And so this inflation of numbers is extremely damaging, not just to recognizing Stalin's crime against Ukrainians, but in also still making sure that people understand the effect and the criminality of the Holocaust itself for Jews. So this is these are extremely important, horrific, murderous events that can be studied and analyzed side by side and don't need to negate each other in sort of the academic realm.
Yeah, there was a very powerful book, which I found very inspiring, Michael Rothberg's Multidirectional Memory, and arguing exactly that case, that the Holocaust could be used to inform the public about other crimes. There's no, awareness of the Holocaust does not preclude awareness of the Armenian genocide or of Stalin's collectivization or of the UPA's mass murder of Poles. One doesn't exclude the other. If you study these processes of violence and dehumanization, we can study them in tandem, but that's not how it's been done. And that is a problem here, that this sort of memory culture, which was developed, the whole term Holodomor appeared in Canada, was re-exported to Ukraine roughly in the 1990s, at a time when the Holocaust became a central focal point of Western historical memory. Then they re-exported this narration of Holodomor to Ukraine, and both Kravchuk and Kuchma and Yushchenko and Poroshenko, they're all on record claiming 10 million people dead in the famine. So they're inflating that one, right? Mm-hmm. And when Yushchenko turned the organization Ukrainian nationalists into official heroes, then it's going to be very difficult to have a candid reckoning with these groups' involvement in the Holocaust.
Yeah, absolutely right.
And it's also, of course, this ethnic component of this, right? One of the most, the Soviet historiography was tossed out the window after 1991. The sort of legitimizing Soviet discourse was out. And what it did was that they copied, actually, a book which has many, many merits, Orest Subtelny's History of Ukraine, which appeared in 1988 in English, then it appeared in Ukrainian translation. And it could almost like send over these like floppy disks back then, the PDFs, and it was printed in large editions. And for a number of years in the 1990s, you could barely find Ukrainian history book anywhere which did not cite Orest Subtelny's Historia Ukraine, the history of Ukraine, right? It became, as my former doctoral supervisor used to joke, the new Lenin, sort of like a must go to reference, right? And right. In that book, I think, if I'm not mistaken, there are four or five pages, even less, dealing with other nationalities than Ukrainians, right? This is about the history of ethnic Ukrainians. In the absence of Ukrainian state, this becomes a history of ethnic Ukrainians, right? He was professor at York University in Ontario, in Toronto. So of course here, that this was land in which all the Western Ukrainian cities had Jewish or Polish pluralities, that the Ukrainians were 9% in Lviv, a little bit more than Ivano-Frankivsk, but these were Jewish cities. The cities in the east were dominated by Russians. There were Armenians, there were Czechs, there were even a couple of Swedish villages, right? They were Genoese, they were Tatars and whatnot. That sort of history was not really accounted for. It became sort of an ethnic history of the Ukrainian ethnic suffering. And the Holodomor became the ethnic, it was ethnicized. As right. The extermination of ethnic Ukrainians. This was, of course, Stalin was collectivizing the agriculture. He declared the kulaks, we are liquidating the kulaks as a class. This was a class murder. But the reading here is that this was an extermination of the Ukrainian nation. It's an ethnocide, right?
Yeah.
In order to fulfill the UN definition, the UN Convention on the Prevention of the Crime of Genocide. Aspects of this that are unfortunate. And we missed so many chances to address this. And now, of course, with this war in Ukraine, I have a large endowment from the Wallenberg Foundation. I have a research group here of 11 people. And I have to say, I have mixed emotions about emphasizing Ukrainian nationalist political violence during World War II, particularly when Putin is using this propaganda. Look here, they were fascist then, they're fascist now. Of course not fascist now. Ukraine is a vibrant, if imperfect, but a vibrant democracy. Right. But it does have historical memory, which has not accounted for and addressed issues which are very important and central to European social and political and historical memory. And they don't even understand how central that is. Of course, Ukraine is not unique. You have this similar situation in Lithuania, in Poland, in Croatia, in Hungary and whatnot. But Ukraine is particularly vulnerable. And throughout this process, what I want to do is sort of like to try to integrate the history of the Holocaust with histories of other political murder and terror. To raise the issues, because we can't just wish them away. We right. can't just emphasize Ukrainians with victims. With independence also comes agency. You know, Ukrainians were also actors, not only objects in history.
Yeah.
And if you just emphasize the victimization narrative, you know what? What room does it leave Ukrainians? I want to bring the Ukrainians in.
Curious Canadian history. We'll be back after the break.
This is such an interesting lesson on just facing your own historical past. You don't, you know, it's healthy and it's important in, especially in liberal democracies, that we face, you know, and Canada has been going through it with, you know, residential schools and the treatment of Indigenous persons in this country and First Nations. So I think this is part and parcel of a demand that we have to be facing these issues, these pasts. And this brings me to, what are the liabilities when you don't face this? Like, what are the liabilities right now? Because we have geopolitical ramifications of these academic, you know, realizations, do we not?
Yeah, in the immediate short term, like this past 2 weeks since this Hunka scandal, it is, of course, that it's discrediting and embarrassing Canada in the eyes of the world. This has been top news in Sweden. But here it doesn't change your opinions towards Ukraine, because it's consensus from right to left. You know, 100% in parliament support Ukraine, and there's no doubt about that, right? But in other countries, it's different. It's harming Canada's foreign policy interest, and even more so, harming Ukraine. Mm-hmm. But in the long run, I mean, you know, I mean, of course, you can always raise those issues, you know, I mean, objections. Well, we talk about the Holocaust, we say never again, and yet we have Darfur, we have Rwanda, we have Srebrenica, but we have Syria. But guess what? We don't have these things taking place in Luxembourg or in Saskatchewan or in Norway, in societies where you have liberal democracy and you do have this forced society to address also the most, the nastiest and most difficult questions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why Germany is a much better society, for instance, than, for that matter, Japan or Turkey. Turkey has criminalized, and Turkey is a criminal offense to affirm the Armenian genocide. Japan has not addressed their sort of a Korean women, comfort women, and so on, right?
Yeah.
And in society, Russia, I mean, don't get me started. I mean, like, they total denial there. Well, why is Germany a better society than Russia? Because they do address this. Why is Canada a better society? Because they actually do have the mechanisms to address residential schools and whatever issues there are. And that's what makes society a good society on a sort of basic level. And in the absence of these critical discussions, you leave this sort of like these wounds to fester. You get the sourdough, right? It's sort of growing by itself, right? And before Hunka was given a standing ovation by Krista Freeland and from Justin Trudeau, had Krista Freeland been more candid about her grandfather's background, for instance, had she been more candid about Ukrainian World War II? She was raised in this tradition, in this scouting organization PLAST, which they regularly saluted and celebrated the Waffen-SS Galician veterans. That was part of her upbringing. So, of course, but she would know, of course, somebody, 98-year-old from Western Ukraine, born in 1925, a Canadian hero fighting the Bolsheviks. Well, there are only two options. Either he was in the UN or he was in the Waffen-SS Galician. A few other options, right? She knew this. She could have addressed this. Not many issues. I don't want to single her out. But, you know, these issues have not been addressed, and they take on a life of their own. And the only way to deal with this is to deal with traditional messy history. And if historians make people feel proud and comfortable about their past, they probably haven't done their job. I mean, well, that's, you know, right?
That's,
you know,
it. That's it. Right.
And I
there.
Love Canada. You know, well, there's some things about, you know, Alberta. You know, that I don't like. You know, all about that. But by and large, you know, nicest people. I think back upon my almost 10 years in Alberta with a lot of fondness, and you know, I was so happy to see you here. Very nice, decent, hardworking people, right? I really like Canadians, right?
Yes.
But this whole idea of this multiculturalism, normative multiculturalism, like every society is multicultural, right? Sweden has been multicultural as long as we've been drinking coffee and reading Martin Luther's translation of the Bible or whatnot, right? But normative multiculturalism in that sense, right, that you have like in the Canadian 1971 version, which Sweden copied, unfortunately, in 1975, the whole idea here that the government is doling out money. We support here the Druze community, the Ukrainian community, the Serbian community. And then, of course, you know, who are the Ukrainians? Well, something happened. You know, let's go and get the Ukrainian vote. Let's voice. Or let's go and get the Muslim voice. 9/11 happens. And you get somebody with a kaftan and a beard who looks Muslim and whatnot. You get Ukrainian voice, somebody in the Vyshovanka taking, you know, from an organized community. And it's, of course, a saying in English, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. So those people who speak for the Serbians or the Ukrainians or the Hungarians tend to be not very representative. Ukrainian Canadian Congress love to present themselves as speaking for 1.3 million Ukrainian Canadians. Well, no, guess what? If you look at this Ukrainian censuses, right, they include all the people that are identified as partially Ukrainian, right? You can be, since it's like your family, I'm sure you have non-Ukrainians in your background too, right? Sure, if you have like three quarters German, then Polish, then Italian, then Ukrainian. Well, if you have one indicator Ukrainian, then, I mean, the people that are singly only Ukrainian are about 200,000. And the people that actually speak Ukrainian at home were, before this war started, you know, I think a few tens of thousands of people. And the people that are organized in the organization of the Ukrainian Nationalists or in Ukrainian Canadian Congress, they count in the, at best in the tens of thousands, plus some church groups. So these people represent a few thousand people, speak in the name of 1.3 million people, and they come in the professionally ethnic outfits and explain, I speak for Ukraine. And they get the money from the government. They get to send out this very simplistic narrative. They get tax-exempt status. They get reduced postage. So you have this Ukrainian-Canadian Congress, you know, safeguarding or policing a certain selective narrative down to the point of setting up task forces to go after and silence critical voices like John Paul Himka, and they went after Margushi for a while. They went after me. You know, I got, was, you know, on a regular basis, they come in on a regular basis, these letters from these patriots in Toronto or whatnot from the Ukrainian nationalist organizations. And they don't write me, they write to my university and my administrators and allege that I'm a Russian agent, I'm practicing hate speech, you know, in a very, very Stalinist way, right? They don't engage me in a discussion, which is, you know, which I would be happy to do. So, you know, they have these authoritarian right-wing groups that get funding from the state and build a monument to Shukhevich with the multicultural funding. You have here a monument to an ethnic cleanser, an anti-Semite, and a Nazi collaborator built, sponsored by Pierre Trudeau's multicultural funding, which was intended to stimulate tolerance, pluralism, and whatnot, right? This is short-circuiting there, which is not unique for Canada. You have it in Sweden too, even though we don't have many Ukrainians here. We didn't have many Ukrainians, but you have here the Grey Wolves, the Turkish radical nationalists. You have Eritrean cultural organizations, and you have other societies who get money from the state in order to, you know, if we stimulate them and treat them with respect, they become good Swedes or good Canadians. But in many ways, the money goes into groups which are separatists or are not interested in supporting the sort of mainstream values, which I think you and I and most historians would agree upon.
Let's just make it clear, like people were trying to shut you up while you were working on this material, right? I mean, you're not making this up. You were sent letters. The institution was sent letters telling them, you know, this guy is a Russian agent. He's spreading lies, things like this. I mean, like this did happen in Canada and outside of Canada while you were doing your work, did it not?
It's happening now. I got those letters as late, you know, last year. I got 6 or 7 more of those. And these are for the organized Ukrainian community in Canada, the League of Ukrainian Canadians, which is the front organization of the Ukrainian organization of Ukrainian nationalists, the Bandera Wing, which are very well represented in the Ukrainian Canadian Congress. The previous director, national president, Paul Grodd, was active in this circle. So, I mean, I'm not the martyr here. Like, you know, in Ukraine, I would be very reluctant to raise these issues. In Poland, I would be very reluctant to raise this issue. If I was a young grad student again, I don't know if I would have done this, right? But here now, I'm one of the lucky ones. I sit here in Sweden, I have a tenured position, and I can speak my mind. But I did speak about this before I had that. There were, of course, liabilities with this. But I mean, you know, I can speak about this. My Belarusian, Russian colleagues and friends cannot. So I'm no martyr here. Yeah. And what was interesting is that in Canada, where the humanities are underfunded, they are, of course, depending on funding from donors. In Sweden, where the universities are public and funded by taxpayers, the pros and cons, of course, is that the salary is much lower here, but we have no tuition fees. So it's a democratic process in that too, the pros and cons. But the good thing here is that all our administration is open. So when these ethno-nationalists in Toronto starting emailing the Swedish embassy, the vice chancellor or three consecutive vice chancellors at the University of Lund, one after another, this, of course, in the public domain, they get stamped and so on, and they're shared with me here. So unlike when they did this to Magoshchi in Toronto, that did this to David Marples in Alberta, that did this to John Polimka in Alberta. He could not see the letters. He could see the responses there. But Universal Alberta, they told John Polimka, you know, well, the Jacek Foundation in Toronto is very upset right now. Jacek was one of those people who volunteered for the Waffen-SS, but he wasn't accepted, but became a very sort of like, you know, historical activist. They were bombarding the Universal Alberta with complaints about John Polimka. And the dean there told him to keep it down. You're ruffling feathers because they might pull this funding, as they were discussing in these task forces. Here now, there's no funding they can pull. And I thought, okay, I got all this documentation, which John Polimka could not get and Magoshchi could not get. So I did in sort of discourse analysis. What do they argue? Well, you know, they cite the Swedish intelligence agencies that Russia is trying to infiltrate, undue influence in Savary, blah, 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 blah. What else did it say? That I'm repeating Soviet narrative, I'm defaming the heroic Waffen-SS, this is regurgitating Soviet lies, I'm practicing hate speech, and we are very concerned about this. And of course, the Ukrainian Canadians like yourself feel unsafe because it was somebody who vandalized the monument to Shukhevich, spray paint the Nazi or whatnot on him. And so now they can sleep at night, and that is my fault. And then you have to tell my head of the department and my dean and my university about this, and then ask and say, well, we're concerned about this because we're victims of hate crimes. Can we have a dialogue with you about this, right? And I would imagine the way they formulate this is like, they're not doing this for the first time. That this is standard procedure. They have done this, developed this art for the past 30, 40 years. Right. So on one hand, accuse me of being a foreign agent and a traitor and a hater, at the same time as they are willfully lying about me to my bosses, right? So it's like, so they accuse me of lies while lying themselves. So it's like, how do you deal with this? But of course, this is how the organization Ukrainian Nationalists operates. This is Ivan Lysak-Rudnitsky, who was John Polimka's predecessor as a monumental figure of Ukrainian history. He wrote about this in the 1970s, called this homegrown fascists and black hunters and whatnot. So, of course, all communities have those. But in the Ukrainian community, they are particularly powerful in terms of controlling memory and determining how memory should be done. But they don't speak for... You know, like yourself, the bulk of Ukrainian Canadians, this 1.3 million people, they're like Hawke Knight in Canada. They like this, you know, watered down Molson beer and pickup trucks and Shania Twain. I don't know what's quintessentially Canadian, right? They don't really care so much for the Waffen-SS and Galitzin, if they even know about them, right? And I'm not sure that they are served justice by having Paul Grodd or whatnot, you know, the Ukrainian Canadian Congress explaining that I'm speaking in Dave Burry's name because you don't even know these people, right? So so there's this sort of like, you know, ethno-nationalism that is, should be problematized, and the Canadian system of normative multiculturalism has fed into this.
And
I think here now, time is open to discuss this. It's been discussed in Sweden, in the Netherlands, and other countries which dabbled in these policies and then started to problematize them. And that's what I'm doing here in my research project.
How do you think this is going to move forward for you?
Old-fashioned, empirical, messy history. Going to the archives. Address the difficult questions. The messier, the dirtier, the better. History should not only be about victimization and compensation, but, you know, I think these issues, as unpleasant as they might be, tells us more about the society we want to be than, you know, than Karl the 12th, Charles the 12th, or heroic defenders of the Lutheran faith who shed the blood in the battlefield of Lützen in 1632 on the 6th of November, right?
Absolutely.
We move ahead of that. You know, we're historians. We're not fairy tale producers. And I do my research. I speak to other historians. I don't think necessarily it's a point at this point to have a dialogue with, say, the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies. I tried that. I was stonewalled. I don't think the Ukrainian Canadian Congress, for instance, is ready for dialogue. They need to address their own past. Right. You know, now they have they issued a very sad statement on their website. You know, how they're very sorry about this. You know, violence is bad, Holocaust is bad, hatred is bad, and we are very sorry. You know, nothing about how they have failed systematically to critically engage the UND, UPA, Bandera, and the Waffen-SS Halicina. What was repeated about rot in the Ukrainian Parliament was what the Ukrainian Canadian Congress for 40 years has been propagating. Now the chickens are home to roost and they have some soul searching to do. And how did Canada end up here? And Canada has the mechanisms. Canada is unlike, unfortunately, many other European countries, including those in the European Union, like Poland or Hungary for that matter, or Ukraine. You know, they're not fully developed democracies. Canada is in many ways maybe not a model democracy, but a very well-functioning society.
Yes.
And the paradox is they have all those mechanisms to do this. So if I cannot talk about this here in Sweden, or you cannot do it, who's going to do it? In Poland, they are having an authoritarian backlash. Hungary, even worse so, right? You know, so it also takes place in Europe. So we have a duty here to address those issues. And I hope that when Ukraine, they will prevail, they will win this war, they will join the European Union, they will join NATO, they will be part of the Euro-Atlantic community. Any doubts that many might have had, and I had some reservations myself after the enlargement of the European Union, they have to be set aside. It's going to be very painful, very costly, but I don't see any alternative to integrating Ukraine into the European Union and the community, where it belongs, or it wants to join. And as future partners and allies, we need to start these discussions and thereby helping Ukraine. And I wish Ukrainian Canadian Congress would land in that same sort of conclusion also.
I want to thank you all for listening today. Don't forget, you can find me on Twitter at Doc Boris. That's at DocBoris. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Patreon. And you can find us on all podcast listening devices. And please do not hesitate to write and leave a comment. We love to hear from you. I'm David Boris. Stay curious, friends.